recovering salmon and dams. And then the future for not just hydropower, which a lot of people think about, but farming in Washington. Farming relies on the dams, the infrastructure that we have here in Washington. What happens to all of this if, as some suggest, those dams or some of those dams, particularly on the lower Snake River, are removed? Could be devastating, as we've heard from other guests here on the program. Welcome back to the Farming Show here on KGMI. Of course, this isn't directly in Whatcom or Skagit County where we're based for the radio show here, but we talk about farming issues now across Washington State, and this is a huge question for people growing food in the state. What is the future of these dams? And somebody that I've been following for some time on social media has a lot to say about the dams, how they work, and what the future should be and could be, depending on what people decide. He calls himself the armchair engineer. Adam Ratliff joins us on the program right now. Welcome to the Farming Show here, Adam. And first off, how did you get into doing all of this? You know, you have a YouTube channel, you're on Instagram and other places, talking about infrastructure and bridges, and in particular dams in Eastern Washington and Oregon and Idaho. What got you into this?
Oh, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on the show. This is really exciting. I have always been passionate about this subject matter. I feel like dams and water projects are some of the most underappreciated and yet fascinating pieces of infrastructure that we have. Really, what America was able to build in the 20th century with its water systems have become the envy of the world. And much of the developing world is trying desperately to build what we built 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. And but unfortunately, a lot of people don't know where their food comes from, and they don't know where their power comes from. And so my content is designed to help bridge that knowledge gap and fill people in on a fascinating bit of our critical infrastructure.
Adam is based over there in the Palouse, so this is right in his backyard. So what is the lowdown on the lower Snake River dams? What's the debate there?
Yeah, so the lower Snake River dams are some of the most remote pieces of what we call the river highway. On the East Coast, there are dozens and dozens of ports and rivers where you can transport goods and crops hundreds of miles inland. And on the West Coast, there are actually only two. One is the river that goes up to Sacramento through the Bay Area, and the other is the Columbia Snake River system. We can transport goods up and down the river all the way to Lewiston, Idaho. And that's a very critical part of ag in the Pacific Northwest. There's several industries that just economically wouldn't be viable if you didn't have that water highway. This is very normal in other parts of the United States. But unfortunately, because of the remote location, because not a lot of people know about them, four dams on the lower Snake River are currently targets for demolition. And as counterintuitive as this may sound, the way that they're approaching this is by trying to convince the public that these dams really don't matter. They're trying to do an information campaign where they tell people they don't produce very much power, and that the river transportation that they do could easily be replaced by just loading stuff onto trucks or maybe trains. And nothing could be further from the truth. But the truth is these are critical pieces of infrastructure that people benefit from every day, but they very rarely see them because of their remote location.
Okay, so first let's talk about hydropower, because that's what most people think about when they think about dams. And the argument Correct. That some are making is that, well, these lower Snake River dams that we want to take out for salmon recovery don't really produce that much power, and we could replace it in different ways. What's the truth about that?
Well, the case that's being made is that the lower Snake River dams produce a pitiful 3% of the power in the Northwest, and oh man, we could replace 3%, because what's 3%? But the truth is, we all know that percentages can be deceptive. The Pacific Northwest is a net exporter of power, meaning that we produce more power than we need, but that power then gets used by people who desperately need it, particularly the states of California and Nevada. And so that 3% represents an enormous amount of energy, both as total capacity expressed in megawatts, but also in total quantity, which is in gigawatt hours. If you were to take the four Snake River dams, which individually they're not necessarily the biggest, most impressive structures, they're still impressive, but they are run-of-the-river dams. If you were to take the four of them and treat them as one unit, it would be the second largest power station in the entire Pacific Northwest, second only to Grand Coulee, which is so large it dominates everything.
Right.
Really, it's because of Grand Coulee that any other power station looks small in comparison. And so it's really an unfair comparison to say that they produce a small amount of power. Anywhere else, if you were to take those dams and put them anywhere else in North America, they would be considered giants, critical giants of clean energy.
And I think it should be mentioned as well, the kind of power they produce is different in terms of its reliability and what it means to the grid, right? The reservoir created by each of these dams is power storage.
That's correct. It's not necessarily the most power storage. Like Grand Coulee has the ability to store power in a way that dwarfs everything else. But what's great about hydropower is that you can turn it on at the flip of a switch. And sometimes that means mere minutes from startup to going online. That is different than, say, a coal-fired plant or a natural gas plant where, actually not natural gas, but let's say heavier fossil fuels like oil and gas or oil and coal. Plants like that take hours to start up. Nuclear plants, which are also extremely extremely clean, they take days to start up. And then you have wind and solar, which are fantastic. They're very clean, but they are what we call intermittent power. You have no control at all as to when you turn them on. And so the term that they use in the industry is dispatchable power. You can flip a switch and get energy when you need it, which during a cold snap is the difference between people freezing to death or not.
Yeah, that is a big deal. And we experienced that this winter with a super cold, you know, record-setting cold temperatures in some areas. Suddenly, they were asking people to conserve power, and that was scary. What do you do when it's so cold?
Yeah.
To stay warm, especially as we push to electrify everything and move away from natural gas heat in homes.
That's true. And the thing about having dispatchable power through the Snake River dams, it's not just the ability to turn it on and off. It's also its relationship to the other power systems in the grid. A lot of people don't realize this, but every time you build a wind or a solar plant, which again, wind and solar is fantastic, you have to compensate by having dispatchable power in equal measure to help load balance. And so if you have a high load day and you're using your solar plant and the sun goes behind the cloud, for those however many long hours the sun's behind the cloud, you have to compensate with a power source that you can turn on a flick of a switch. And so there's a symbiotic relationship between wind and solar and the dams. And unfortunately, that's getting twisted. People are now saying we should tear down the dams and replace them with wind and solar, which is just not possible. That's like saying, hey, you got an F-150 with 150 horsepower. Let's replace your pickup truck with 150 horses.
Right.
That's not the same thing. Like just, you know, on paper maybe, but in reality, that's not how it works.
Not actually apples with apples. This is the Farming Show here on KGMI. I'm Dylan Honkoop. Our guest right now is the armchair engineer, Adam Ratliff, based in Eastern Washington, talks a lot on social media and shares his depth of knowledge about dams and other infrastructure. What we're talking about right now is dams, because those are so controversial here in Washington State. And of course, this is the Farming Show. We've talked about hydropower. I guess one impact to farming there, you could say, well, hydropower, what does that have to do with farming and dams? But, you know, the wind and solar projects that are proposed also have an impact on farmland and other things like that. But, you know, more directly impacting to farming is, you talked about transportation. What about irrigation from these dams? I know that's another big part of the recipe. And, you know, ultimately, what are the big losses that you would see agriculture agriculture experiencing if they took these dams away?
Well, the biggest loss for agriculture with the Snake River dams, hands down, would be transportation.
Yeah,
there's an enormous amount of grain that's transported downriver from the inland part of Washington and Oregon and even parts of Idaho that travels by barge up to 500 miles. All the way down to the port of Portland, where it's then transported for export and also regional use. The economics of that are completely thrown askew if you eliminate that river highway. I like to think of some of our major highways going over the mountains, like, say, Snoqualmie Pass. We've all driven over I-90. And as you go over I-90, just east of the lake, there's that wildlife overcrossing where the elk can go across the highway. You know, when I-90 was built in the 50s, it separated the elk herds from one side of the lake to the other. Those two herds couldn't move anymore. And it negatively affected the biodiversity of the region. But you know what we didn't do to fix that problem? We didn't tear out the freeway going over the Snoqualmie Pass, right? Mm-hmm. We built an overcrossing and, you know, problem solved. Similar thing going on with our river highway. Of course, dams aren't good for the ecology, right? But they're also not a deal breaker, right? The salmon are still running and in decent enough numbers that they're sustainable. What we don't do is completely gut a major transportation corridor because of an unintended consequence. There are ways to mitigate those unintended consequences. And if you were to eliminate the river highway, you would completely change the economics of our food supply, greatly, greatly hurting our food security, potentially worldwide, because every bit counts. You know, just a few months ago, the country of Ukraine lost a dam that, while not a large dam, it was responsible for irrigation to a huge amount of production acreage. And that crop promptly failed because of that piece of infrastructure, and that affected prices worldwide. We would have a similar thing happen here domestically, except it would be self-inflicted. So we definitely don't want to go down the road of eliminating that transportation corridor. As far as irrigation is concerned, yeah, there are many growers, particularly fruit growers, on the lower part of the Snake that rely on the water being at a certain level and at a consistent level. If the river were to be quote-unquote freed, what that means is dramatically lower levels in the summer when you need the water the most, and high levels in the spring when you don't need it as much, and it's hard to build things in a raging river. Going back to a wilded river really means trading off most of the development that we have on its banks. And I don't think that the operators who are growing fruit there in the Tri-Cities area could really sustain their operations if the river doesn't have a consistent flow.
So yeah, what happens to all that? All that goes away again. What are the ripple effects? And I think that's important that you point out that example from Ukraine. You know, we aren't doing this in a vacuum. It's not just Washington State. This is a global economy now.
Yeah. Well, if you look at if you pull up Google Maps right now and look at the Tri-Cities of Washington, on the east side of that green patch, every single one of those circles is represented by irrigation water. Every single one of those orchards is being pulled from the Snake River. So all that area stops being green and starts being brown. It just goes back to sagebrush. We're not making any more cropland, right? Farms aren't growing in that way. They're consolidating, but we're not adding new cropland. And so subtracting cropland in the name of salmon ecology is a dangerous road to go down, because these dams are just as symbolic as they are practical. Mm. The goal here is not just the Snake River dams. They don't stop there, right? If the reasons for taking out the Snake River dams are valid, then they're all coming out, all the way down. We're talking McNary, we're talking John Day, all the way to Portland, and then we're going up the middle Columbia to Grand Coulee. And we're talking about millions of acres out of production from Yakima to Wenatchee. I mean, basically the agriculture industry of Washington and the Pacific Northwest is in the crosshairs with these dams. If these dams come out, you're going to have a hard time justifying pulling water out of the Yakima River at Sunnyside or Prosser or Ellensburg. Like, this is a domino effect that won't stop if people buy the lie that these dams are not critical infrastructure.
Well, and there's another question. Some people are saying, well, you know, all of this might be worth it to save the salmon. What has your research shown about the truth there? Would removing these dams move the needle for salmon recovery?
It would move the needle a little bit. It wouldn't be the silver bullet that people are saying it is, simply because the issues that are leading to juvenile mortality on the Lower Snake River are bigger than these four dams. It comes down to how the regions of southern Idaho treat their rivers. I don't want to pick on other ag regions, but let's just say that Washington has a much better track record with water quality than Idaho does. There are other dams on the Snake that we're not talking about that actually do block migration. But for some reason, we're talking about the dams that don't block migration.
They have salmon passage, right?
They have excellent salmon passage, some top of the line.
Yeah, I think people don't understand exactly how that even works, but
it works extremely well. I live about 20 minutes away from one of those dams. You can go down there, visit the fish ladders, and you can see full-size coho salmon moving up the river. There's a myth out there that the river is devoid of salmon. Well, I'll state it more comprehensively. There's a myth out there that there used to be a lot of fish in the water until we built the dams. And the myth says, therefore, if we remove the dams, the fish will come back.
Right.
That is not true. The years of abundance were first talked about by the Core Discovery, Lewis and Clark, when they came over in 1805. And it lasted until about the 1890s, when really the major companies that were exploiting the river just absolutely gutted the salmon runs through the overfishing, as well as a lot of loss of habitat in the high country due to mining. That's when we lost the salmon numbers. And we know that because we can measure how many salmon have come up the Columbian Snake from 1936 forward, when they started counting at Bonneville Dam during the New Deal. So we know what happened to the fish. We're kind of scapegoating these dams that were built in the 1970s, but the natural runs were greatly diminished decades before that. And so if you were to remove the dams, you could probably expect the runs to come back to the modest ones we had in the 1960s, which was nothing to write home about. The truth is, some great things have happened with the ecology and the sustainability of the run that if it was any other species, we would celebrate it. For example, if we have a species that is nearing extinction that happens to be a mammal or avian or a bird, whatever, and we successfully breed them in captivity and then reintroduce them to the wild successfully, we consider that a win. With fish, on the other hand, the way the Endangered Species Act is written, we don't consider it a win. We consider them a separate category that don't count to the main species. So every hatchery fish that successfully navigates the Snake River doesn't count. The only ones that count are the ones that have no hatchery fish or any human anything anywhere in their lineage. It doesn't matter if they spawn naturally today. If they are descended from fish that humans helped, they don't count. And it's this weird accounting trick that gives the perception that there are no fish in the river when there's actually plenty of fish. They just don't count in the Endangered Species Act. And really, it's a fluke in the way the law is written, because we don't treat any other species that way, right? Like if I have a farm and the herd of elk on one side don't intermix with the herd of elk on the other side of my farm, I don't get to count them as two different species, right? Yeah. They're all elk, right? If we put them together, they would mate, it'd be fine, right? It's the same thing. They just have two different herds. With fish, we get to count them as separate species if they come from a different mile of the river, if they spawn in a different month. Like the granularity of the definition of the word species is really the scandal here. Because if you look at the fish biomass as a whole, the numbers are actually pretty encouraging. They're definitely sustainable. The fish are in no danger of going extinct. We will have salmon for the next 1,000 years if we keep doing what we're doing. But because of the way they narrowly define species, it allows them to say the fish that spawned in this gravel bed are a different species from the ones that spawned a mile downstream. And then you get to declare each one of those gravel beds as an endangered species. And then you start adding up the lawsuits based on how many endangered species are affected by the dams. It's really just a trick of account.
It's crazy. And what the trade-off for, you know, dubious potential benefits to salmon, you know, whether it would really help them or not is a huge question. Yet we are looking at sacrificing all these things that we talked about before for that pie in the sky hope. It is insane to think about. We just have 30 seconds left, but what do you think the MO is here, Adam?
Like, where do I think this is going?
No, what do you think the true motives of people pushing this? Because it just doesn't seem honest.
Well, I'm not a conspiracy guy. I think that there's very well-meaning but misinformed people out there who have bought into a dream that they haven't really thought through. The dream of wild rivers. I mean, I get it, right? We all like a babbling brook. We all like whitewater rafting. I get that part of it. What people forget is that in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, dam building and water projects was a progressive cause.
Yeah.
If you were liberal, you were all in for dam building. If you were conservative, you wanted to leave things exactly the way they were.
Right.
And the progressives of today have kind of bought into this idealism that says the best thing we can do for the future is to tear down the progress of the past. We wouldn't do that with civil rights. We wouldn't do that with water quality, right? You know, like the things that have gotten us today, more people have been pulled out of poverty by these dams.
Yeah.
And I'm speaking generally about dams than by maybe any other public works project, you know, save maybe the interstate highway system. It's truly amazing how our standard of living in North America has gone up as a direct result of these dams. And it's just kind of a naive blindness that says we will somehow make progress by going backwards.
Excellent, excellent points. Thank you so much to the armchair engineer with us on the farming show here on KGMI, Adam Ratliff, based over in the Palouse, talking about dams with us today. Thank you so much for your time, Adam.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.